Reserve. Now, that was a system that didn't avoid crisis, because it was claimed that that it would, but it didn't. They had a number of banking panics. The major one was in 1907, and it was used as the justification, rationalization, if you will, for the Federal Reserve System. And the Federal Reserve System was put in for exactly that reason. We have an unstable system. We have to make it better. We're going to make it scientific. We'll end depressions, blah, blah, blah. That all
would need elastic currency.
Elastic currency, that's right. No sooner did they put it in, they had a depression in 1921, and then they had the big blowout in 29 through 32. All right, so it proved its worth in the first great test, and it failed. So we're going to see a rehash of that. Same type of situation. Monetary instability, the same people are going to come back and say, oh, we've got a better system for you, but now they have the added little twist that it's going to take our governmental structure from a national level to this supranational hemispheric level. Now, you say that they are aware of the coming crises. Sure they are. But they also understand something here, that these kinds of crises can get out of hand because the whole system is based upon confidence. It's a confidence, I like to say, it's a confidence game in two senses of that word. It's a confidence game in the sense of it's a swindle, and it's a confidence game in the sense of it depends upon people having confidence, people believing in the swindle. As soon as people start realizing that they're being swindled and they lose confidence, the confidence game no longer works, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, when that happens, you're going to have social and political consequences which the establishment will not like. And that's why they're setting up the Homeland Security Department the way they are. That's why they're paramilitarizing local and state police. That's why they're talking about, they've done it, John Warner Appropriations Act of 2007, allowing the president to use the National Guard throughout the country in terms of any kind of public disturbance that he thinks endangers public order. All of that is being set up, not, I believe, because they're afraid of Muslim terrorists or any of that nonsense. It's because they expect to see, as you have more and more of these crises leading, I think, in the direction of hyperinflation, because that, at least, they think they can maneuver better than a depression. You're going to see social dislocations. You're going to see situations in which public order really does break down. And they want to be able to control that on the streets. And they're going to do that through the Homeland Security Department and this paramilitarization of federal, state, and local police, National Guard, and so forth and so on. And then under those circumstances, assuming that they have control of the streets, assuming that, of course, they maintain control of Congress and the presidency and the Federal Reserve, that whole huge bureaucracy in Washington, then their next step will be, under those conditions in which people are screaming for help, they will lay on the table the North American Union and the Amero and probably some other provisions and say, see what we've done, we've saved you again. Just as we saved you in 1913 with the Federal Reserve System, we're saving you now with the Amero Bank or whatever they call it. And Americans, unfortunately, lots of them, because they've been miseducated by the indoctrination system, will say, great, we'll accept that because we'll at least have some jobs, we'll at least have some income, we'll have a semblance of stability, and that's better than chaos. And, of course, it will have been engineered chaos, and it will be an engineered stability. I mean, it's all a charade, but the average person, you know, he's going to grasp at whatever straw if he's sinking economically into the septic tank, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
So that's their plan. And it's a plan they've used before.
This sounds like something that they've done over in Europe. Are there parallels between what they did in Europe and bringing about the euro and what they'll do here?
Well, I think they didn't have to go as far in the allowance for chaos.
Okay, well, Edwin, we got a commercial break coming up. Listeners, stay tuned. My guest today is Edwin Vieira. This will be a very interesting program.
methods the powers that be don't want you to know. Travel, bank, work, and live anonymously. Live free. You can also order Privacy Crisis by telephone. Call 702-433-6222.
Morning, neighbor.
Hey, shouldn't you be at work?
I am. As a matter of fact, I pulled another all-nighter.
What do you mean?
Well, I'm working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Well, at least I'm making money 24/7, but I never have to go to work.
So what do you do?
Not very much at all now. About a month ago, I heard about this website. It's got a funny name. It's DidYouRobBillGates.com.
That is funny.
Yeah, you can earn $1,200 to $12,000 a week starting the very first week.
Oh, is that how you bought that new mower?
Yeah, and the motorcycle I've always wanted, too. You should log on. Find out how you can become financially free.
So what was that website?
It's www.DidYouRobBillGates.com.
Just wait, I'll go get a pen so I can write that down.
You don't need to write it down. It's easy to remember. DidYouRobBillGates.com.
Yeah, DidYouRobBillGates.com. That is easy.
It's easy, and the money is awesome.
Hi, this is Brother Michael Diamond from Most Holy Family Monastery. We are now offering a critically important $10 package. The package contains three DVDs with 10 different programs, our new 658-page book called The Truth About What Really Happened to the Catholic Church After Vatican II, which is the most comprehensive book ever produced on what has happened to the Catholic Church in the last 50 years. You also get another 335-page book and other material. Order now at our website, mostholyfamilymonastery.com. The last word monastery is spelled M-O-N-A-S-T-E-R-Y. At the website, you can watch all of our videos for free, read sample chapters of the new book and other articles, or call us 24 hours a day at 1-800-275-1126. That's 1-800-275-1126. Or you can mail in your order to us at Most Holy Family Monastery, 4425 Schneider Road, Fillmore, New York, 14735. The price of the whole package is $10, which includes media mail shipping, $15 for UPS ground, or $30 outside the U.S. MostHolyFamilyMonastery.com.
Well, Republican listeners, we're back. My guest is Edwin Vieira. Edwin, let me ask you this simple question, but let me put it into context. Before the break, we were talking about trying to maybe reproduce the European Union and the Euro and do the same thing over here. We have kind of a fact pattern in the past that kind of lends credibility to that, because that's happened in our past. We had the Panic of 1907. As a result of that, we started studying European banking. And there's a whole lot of, in the serial set, you can see all these reports that were generated to build the Federal Reserve System. Mm-hmm. Then we had old Frank Vanderlip and Nelson Aldrich and others hop on the train and they go down to Jekyll Island and they plan all this out. And then they step forward with this legislation that on December the 23rd, 1913, while most of Congress is away for the Christmas holidays, Congress allegedly approves this act. And what happened there was that the banks came along and they became stockholders in each local Federal Reserve Bank. Could they do something like this, that the supranational bank that's going to issue the Amero, whatever its name might be, would first extend its feelers out into the American and Canadian and Mexican banking system and say, hey, look, after we go through this hyperinflationary period, your assets are going to be worth trash. And what you can do is you can convey to us in exchange for stock interest in your local bank. You can exchange your assets and convey them to this supranational bank, and therefore the regional banks that are created in the supranational banks will then acquire all these non-performing assets and give the local banks stock ownership in it, and then you've got all the banks in all three countries are on the take and ready, willing, and able to support this new supranational bank that's going to issue the currency. Is that the way this is going to happen?
Well, it's certainly a very plausible scenario, and I would go one step further. I don't think they're going to need to threaten these banks or in a sense, cajole them into coming into it. I think the banks are all in line to do this.
Absolutely right.
This is to their advantage to do it. Now, they may present to us a different picture of how it's being done, but it's
obviously, when the Federal Reserve was created, all of those national banks that were out there and became the first member banks of the Federal Reserve were not fighting to stay out.
Yes.
They wanted to get in. It was, for their point of view, it was feeding at the trough. Now, in this particular case, obviously the banks will want to get into this because of the fear of increasing instability in the present system. Now, they have lots and lots of assets, but let's take a big commercial bank. Let's say it's holding a lot of mortgage paper. And that mortgage paper obviously now is worth a lot less than it was. Well, they could exchange it unit for unit with new Ameros, right, whatever that unit will be, A's. And now they're getting dollar for dollar on that mortgage paper. And they're getting a stable currency. And that's their entry into the system. You know how the Federal Reserve operates? The regional or the member banks come to the Federal Reserve with some asset, say a U.S. government bond, but it could be a mortgage, package of mortgages. It could be farm produce, for that matter. And the Federal Reserve arranges with the Federal Board of Governors to generate actual currency, if they wanted currency, on the basis of that asset. So I imagine that's how the Amero system would work. These banks that from Canada, Mexico, and the United States that would become the new member banks of the Amero system would bring forth whatever assets they're holding, and those would be the basis on which Ameros would be generated. And now that would enable them to create a whole price structure in Ameros, almost right from scratch. Which, of course, is the major problem in starting any new currency, is what are the prices going to be under that currency. The interesting question is, where is that Amero bank going to come from? You see, there's no North American legislature yet. There's talk among various administrative agencies like the U.S. Commerce Department and its equivalent in Mexico and Canada about these trade agreements. And that I understand to be the basis of building this system. First, you get the trade organized, and then you put up a superstructure of legislation and judiciary and other administrative bodies. But right now, that superstructure isn't there. So where is this America? That's the big question. What are they going to use as the basis for creating the Amero? Clearly, the Federal Reserve can't create it.
Well, there's this possibility that the Federal Reserve could come along and do like what they're doing right now, as they hyperinflate, use, you know, suck up all the assets of the banks that are non-performing, so it'll sit there and hold the subprimes and,
right,
you know, all these bad notes of all these banks. So the banks are sitting there flush with a whole bunch of Federal Reserve credit. Well, then let's, for purposes of discussion today, this supranational bank, let's use the an acronym, Mexico, M, U.S., U.S., C, Canada. Let's call it the Musk Bank.
Right.
The Musk Bank will somehow, some way, acquire all the assets of the Federal Reserve banks and step into its shoes, and then issue stock to the banks in addition to, you know, payments made to the bank of other assets. So it can just simply sit there and, you know, a credit system can suck up any type of assets it wants, you know, extend credits to the bank for assets that are conveyed to it. So it can absorb all these non-performing assets and then just step forth immediately within the span of a month and say, hey, we got a whole monetary system ready to roll.
Oh, well, sure. And in fact, that the Musk Bank could conceivably be entirely a private bank made up of major American, Mexican, and Canadian banks.
So true, so true. Folks, we've got another commercial break. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
The ideology powering the Democrats and Republicans is not liberalism or conservatism, but globalism.
Globalists are concerned with what's good for big business and the American empire instead of what's fair for the American people. The only antidote to the poison of globalism is nationalism. Start reading the Nationalist Times each month. The Nationalist Times promotes a common sense, intelligent, and passionate alternative to the reigning party line. Published monthly since 1985, the Nationalist Times is a 20-page newspaper featuring outstanding writers and columnists who don't believe in taboos or sacred cows. Be one of the many thousands of loyal readers of the Nationalist Times. Subscribe now to the Nationalist Times. Just $19 for 1 year. That's 50% off the regular price. Send your $19 subscription to the Nationalist Times, P.O. Box 426, Allison Park, PA 15101. That's the Nationalist Times, P.O. Box 426, Allison Park, PA 15101. Or subscribe online at our website, www.anu.org. The ideology powering the Democrats and Republicans is not liberalism or conservatism, but globalism. Globalists are concerned with what's good for big business and the American empire instead of what's fair for the American people. The only antidote to the poison of globalism is nationalism. Start reading the Nationalist Times each month. The Nationalist Times promotes a common sense, intelligent, and passionate alternative to the reigning party line. Published monthly since 1985, the Nationalist Times is a 20-page newspaper featuring outstanding writers and columnists who don't believe in taboos or sacred cows. Be one of the many thousands of loyal readers of the Nationalist Times. Subscribe now to the Nationalist Times. Just $19 for 1 year. That's 50% off the regular price. Send your $19 subscription to the Nationalist Times, P.O. Box 426, Allison Park, PA 15101. That's the Nationalist Times, P.O. Box 426, Allison Park, PA 15101. Or subscribe online at our website, www.anu.org.
Oh, we're back, listeners. My guest today is Edwin Vieira. I just got notice from the board operator that we got a tremendous audience on today. And it's obvious because everybody wants to listen to you. So before the break, we were talking about how this Musk Bank,
right,
as an acronym, could be created. What will happen after they create the bank and we start operating on a new currency called the Amero?
Well, I think two important things here. Number one, it will perpetuate the financial power of the very people that we don't want to perpetuate financial power. And that's their goal. Obviously, in a crisis situation, the country can go in two directions. It can change its financial system, and it can remove from positions of political authority those individuals who have messed things up over the decades, if you will. Or we can continue with those people in control and give us some new structure that they are in charge of. So we don't really gain anything in the long run by the latter course of action, but that's certainly what will happen if we accept whatever this bank is, the Musk Bank, as we're calling it now. Secondly, we can be sure that to create that Musk Bank, large amounts of assets are going to have to be transferred into its control.
Right.
It can't generate currency based on nothing. I mean, even the Federal Reserve doesn't generate currency based on nothing. At worst, it takes a government bond, so it's being promised by the Treasury that at some stage taxes will be collected. There is something there in the long run. And then the question becomes, well, where will these assets come from? And one of the things that worries me is it possible that those assets may be essentially stolen from the American people? You can imagine all sorts of eminent domain theories or transfers of securitized mortgages and so forth and so on, in which this Musk Bank, the North American Union Bank, would end up with control of vast amounts of property within the United States as the basis for generating the euro, along the lines of what John Law did in France.
Absolutely.
Right? The famous John Law experiment, because he was using the swampland in Louisiana as the basis, and it failed. But that same principle could be applied again. And then you have the American people now subject even more than they are now, to control and domination and manipulation by the banking and financial community. So another very dangerous thing. And, of course, the third point is once you create
familiarity, local control, all of those elements which are, to my way of thinking, the great characteristics and the reason for the success of our American system since the Constitution was put in. Those things have been under attack since the Wilson administration, obviously, since 1913. And now the people who have been in charge of the political process in this country since 1913 telling us that they're going to give us the coup de grace, they're going to finish it off by taking it to the hemispheric level. And they're not going to stop there, Larry. Let's face it. Their structure is designed first to break the world or to rearrange the world into three blocks, the European bloc, the North and South American bloc, because they will extend this North American union to a hemispheric union.
Then an Asian.
And then an Asian bloc. And then that's the trilateral structure. We know the Trilateral Commission being kind of the front group that has proposed that over the years. And then those three blocks will somehow be merged with a superstructure on top of them, and eventually that will be coalesced into one great
world government.
World government, global government. That's the plan. And it's obvious. You can go back and find this kind of literature laying out this picture probably before the League of Nations after World War One, but certainly during the World War Two and immediately thereafter, that period, because they thought at that time the United Nations might be the vehicle for doing it. They discovered the United Nations really doesn't have the wherewithal to accomplish what they want, and so they have to take these other steps. But the basic plan is still there. So we're looking at, really, and I wrote a column on News Reviews with this title, "Would the North American Union Be American Patriots' Last Stand?" We're really looking at a kind of last stand here, because if we lose our national sovereignty to the North American Union, barring some miraculous event, there's no turning back from that.
Wow, wow.
I don't think there is.
Okay, Evan, let's kind of shape the discussion in the rest of the program.
Sure.
Can we get into how this came to be? Let's get back into a little bit of the history of money and banking and the growth of institutionalized banking in this country. And then after that, let's talk about some solutions.
Okay. Well, there'll be directions. I don't know whether there'll be solutions. There'll be directions.
Okay.
I think it came about primarily, if you will, at least initially by accident. It came about driven by greed. And
well, tell our listeners about fractional reserve banking.
Well, fractional reserve banking is really a form of sleight of hand. If you have what I would call an honest loan bank, what it does is collect deposits from depositors, and then it takes those deposits and lends them at interest to hopefully profit-making ventures. So it's paying a certain amount to its depositors for the use of their money, and then it's trying to loan out that money at a higher interest rate, and the difference between those two rates is how the bank makes its profit and stays in business. But you notice in that system, no new money is created. The only money that's lent is the money that the bank has received from its depositors. That's 100% reserve banking, if you will, or straight loan banking. Fractional reserve banking goes the next step because the bankers discovered that if their depositors gave them money to be withdrawn on demand, that is, the banks promised to pay back that money anytime the depositors came in, most depositors did, in fact, come in and ask for their money to be withdrawn. So the banks discovered that they could loan out some of that money. So instead of having 100% of the funds on deposit, they could only have 90% or 80% or whatever, dependent upon the economic circumstances. Then they discovered that, lo and behold, they didn't even have to loan out the actual money that the depositors gave them. They could create some new bank currency of their own and loan that out. And that was the beginning of banks of issue. They would actually issue currency more than the amount of gold or silver, because gold or silver in those days was the actual money. Bank notes were simply promissory notes. They were promises of the bank to pay. And the banks discovered that those promissory notes would circulate, that they weren't brought back on a regular basis to be redeemed. And obviously it was to their interest economically to loan out more and more and more of those promises because they were making interest on the deal. Now, the difficulty was at some stage down the line, the free market recognizes that there actually is more of this paper floating around than is economically viable. Now some people start taking that paper back to the issuing banks and demanding payment in gold and silver, which the banks have promised to do. The banks suddenly discover, uh-oh, we don't have enough reserves. We can't pay this back. And we have two choices. Either we can go bankrupt, we can declare that our debts are greater than our assets, go out of business, maybe be sued for fraud, our directors and officers, or we can run to the government and ask for some kind of special privilege to protect us. And that's precisely how this whole interface, or incestuous relationship probably is a better term, between banks and government began.
That goes back to the time of William Patterson and the Bank of England.
Well, it had been developed even before then, actually. The goldsmiths had discovered this fractional reserve principle, and there were some other banks that had done this on a smaller scale. But the Bank of England became probably the paradigmatic structure of this kind. Now, we didn't have banks of that nature within the American colonies because in the American colonies, the governments issued their paper money directly. They didn't have there were banks, but they didn't have the kind of relationship we have with the Federal Reserve Bank.
Well, you're talking about the colonial
system. Paper money, bills of credit, they were called. Now, the Founding Fathers discovered something about bills of credit, which was that government treasuries aren't much more responsible than private banks, and they overissue. And the classic example was during the War of Independence, you had overissues of the Continental currency, which was issued by the Continental Congress. And you had overissues by the state treasuries, state bills of credit. So the Constitutional Convention comes along, and the framers said, no, we're going to end this. No state shall emit bills of credit, number one, that eliminates that, and we're not going to give a power to Congress to emit bills of credit. And until the Lincoln administration, during the Civil War, there were no issues of bills of credit by the states or by Congress. What did they do? They began turning to this other mechanism, which was the interface of private banks and government. The states created loads of private banks. Some of them were not really very private because the directors and officers were controlled by the state legislatures, and all the capital came from the state legislatures. At the national level, you had two banks of the United States, the First Bank of the United States, Second Bank of the United States. Those weren't entirely, they were created by Congress. They weren't entirely controlled by the federal government. About 20% of their stockholders, or 20% of the stock was owned by
the United States,
and the rest was owned by private parties. So it was a cooperative venture between the national government and the private stockholders, and they were private banks. Now,
Let me stop you right there. This leads into something a direction I wanted to go with in this radio program. Could you say that the officers of the First Bank of the United States or the Second Bank of the United States were officers of the federal government?
No, in fact, it was held by John Marshall, Chief Justice John Marshall, in Supreme Court's opinion of Osborne versus Bank of the United States, that they were not, notwithstanding that. The Second Bank of the United States was the subject of that case. Under that particular statute, 20% of the directors of the Bank of the United States were appointed by the President of the United States and confirmed by the Senate. And in the Osborne case, Chief Justice John Marshall said, well, that didn't make any difference. They weren't officers of the United States.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
became Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court in the Hepburn versus Griswold
case. Yeah, he held his own act unconstitutional.
He held the act unconstitutional. He said, well, you know, it was a war measure, and we had to do it, but we were wrong, and it's unconstitutional. So I mean, it tends to go to show you how the political pragmatism was controlling events in those days. But that was the first issue of paper currency. Now, at the same time, or closely to it, 1863, Congress also passed what was called the National Currency Act. And this was the beginning of the structure that eventually became the Federal Reserve, the close connection between the financial power structure, the private financial power structure, and the U.S. Treasury. And in fact, if you read the legislative history, it's explained that way. They say, we need to do this because we want to have a close cooperation between private high finance and the U.S. Treasury. And this is how we're going to get it, by giving them these special privileges. And the special privileges were you could create a thing called a national bank, which is a private bank, and then you would take U.S. bonds that you would purchase in the market, take them to the Treasury, and they would give you 90% of the face value of those bonds in a thing called national currency notes, generated by the Treasury. And then you and your private bank could take those national currency notes and loan them at interest. So that was the relationship. The government was allowing you into this process by which you could make money, and you were helping the government by buying U.S. bonds as
so
a security.
Can I stop right here and give a typical example, you know, a hypothetical example? Let's say that a national bank in Chicago had $1 million in U.S. bonds in 1867.
Right.
So it could take that $1 million in bonds to the Treasury and get $900,000 in currency.
Yeah, plus they would continue to get interest on those bonds.
Right. And then they would deposit that in they'd become till money that they could loan out.
Right. At a fractional reserve basis.
Yes, yes, yes. So then they would have $900,000 in reserves. And let's say that the multiplier here is 10. There was a 10% reserve requirement.
Right.
You know, from a practical viewpoint.
Right.
Well, they could then issue $9 million in loan.
Right. I think the multiplier was lower than that, but the point is still made. This was a good deal. Right? This was a good deal that came about through the enactment of a very special political privilege. Now, the problem with that system was that it depended upon government debt. Right? For each $900,000 in currency, you needed to have $1 million in government debt. So there was a limitation, especially after the Civil War, when the attitude in the country was, we want to retire debt. We don't want to increase debt. So that system was inherently limited in its ability to expand. And they also had crises. It was still a fractional reserve system. There were a number of crises. As I said earlier, 1907 was a big one. And that caused pressure coming out of the financial community primarily for reform of the system. So Aldrich, Senator Aldrich and some others, went off on a junket to Europe to study European central banks. And then Aldrich and Paul Warburg and van der Lippe and a number of other Rockefeller and Morgan people went down to Jekyll Island in Georgia, and they met secretly and devised what was essentially the foundational piece of paper for the Federal Reserve Act. Eventually became kind of called the Aldrich Bill, but the basic structure was devised there. It's interesting. People can still go down there. It's now a Marriott Hotel. It was then a private club. It's now a Marriott Hotel, and they have retained that portion, which was there in 1911. And, in fact, they have the room where you can go in. There's even a plaque on the door. It says Federal Reserve Room. You can go in, and there are pictures of the conspirators right there on one of the walls. And you can sit in the place where this whole thing was hatched.
Yeah, you tell about all this in Crashmaker.
Oh, yeah, it's there. You can go down and see it. And I've been there on a number of occasions. Fascinating to be. You can almost feel the ghosts of these people in the woodwork. But in any event, they did that. And they passed the Federal Reserve Act on the basis that it would give a more elastic currency than the National Bank Act. National Bank Act was limited to government debt. The Federal Reserve Act opened that up and said, well, essentially any good asset can be monetized. So the farmers went along with that because they thought it would help them in harvest periods when they needed credit. The manufacturers went along with it. The people who wanted to buy government debt. Everyone who wanted to get into this act essentially had some kind of iron in the fire.
All right, Edwin, we got a break. Stay tuned. This is a very interesting program.
Have you heard of a privacy crisis? Odds are you're already immersed in one. The U.S. government is now legally tapping phones, monitoring emails, tracking purchases, and seizing property in record numbers. Banks are demanding invasive personal information for even the smallest transaction. Unfortunately, stalkers looking to harm you or your financial situation are using the same methods. So how can you protect yourself, your loved ones, and all that you own? Well, the first step is to purchase the most important how-to book you'll ever read. It's called Privacy Crisis by author Grant Hall. In minutes, you'll know the methods he himself has used and advised others about in order to bank anonymously, open a safety deposit box without a social security number. With Privacy Crisis, you'll discover how to avoid judgments, seal your credit files airtight, drop off the radar, and virtually disappear from those looking to cause you injury. The ebook and hardcover versions are available at www.privacycrisis.com. Grant Hall's Privacy Crisis contains information and legal methods the powers that be don't want you to know. Travel, bank, work, and live anonymously. Live free. You can also order Privacy Crisis by telephone. Call 702-433-6222.
Take the heat out of your sleep. The Bedfan Personal Cooling System will work for anyone that is a hot sleeper, regardless of the reason. It gives you a deep, restful sleep, the way nature intended. No more tossing and turning. Say goodbye to sleepless nights. So ask yourself, are you a hot sleeper and really want to sleep cooler? A woman who suffers from the effects of menopause, including night sweats derived from hot flashes, have a medical condition that causes your body to get hot at night, or just want to save money on your air conditioning bill? It works instantly. No tools or assembly required. Don't worry. The Bedfan fits short beds, tall beds, beds with footboards, sleigh beds, water beds, and many other types of beds. If you want great relief and total comfort, give us a call at 1-210-632-8280. That's 1-210-632-8280. Or visit our site at bedfan.com. Your provider for great sleep.
Pinch me, Bill. I can't believe it. A few months ago, I couldn't even afford gas for my car. And here we are with season tickets on the 50-yard line.
I know what you mean, John. I remember the day you saw my new car and asked me if I robbed Bill Gates. Our lives sure have changed since we discovered DidYouRobBillGates.com.
I was struggling to make ends meet. Now I've got a new car. And a college fund for Lisa when she graduates from high school next year. And I owe it all to you. Because you told me about DidYouRobBillGates.com.
Hey, John, we all win when the money problems disappear. I want to tell everybody. Because the more people we have on the success team, the better it works. It's hard for the little guy these days. We pool our resources to level the playing field.
So the more people that go to www.DidYouRobBillGates.com, the more cash for everybody. What a concept.
With the Live Free Zone program, Tommy Cryer's program. I'm the substitute host today, Larry B. Kraft. My guest is Edwin Vieira. Edwin, before the break, we were talking about, we were at the stage where, at the stage of the panic of 1907, and the system that we had, you know, today's system would have been in place back then. We had the conspirators plotting to replace the... We had state banks and we had national banks that were issuing currency back in that day. And now they're going to come forward with a proposal to have a national central bank that's going to issue Federal Reserve notes.
Right, well, actually, we didn't have any state banks issuing currency because there was a law that taxed them. There was a 10% tax.
Yes, you're right.
So they drove the state notes out of centralization. We're always talking about centralization here. You had a lot of state banks pre-Civil War. Post-Civil War, they create the National Currency Act, which is the first attempt to centralize, and they tax the state bank notes out of existence. National Currency Act couldn't work because it was limited by the amount of government debt that the banks could get, and obviously that depended on how much the government would generate. So they didn't have what they considered to be a sufficiently elastic currency, at least elastic in the sense of expanding. They could contract it pretty easily, but they couldn't expand it very well. So that was the first argument. We need an elastic currency that can expand. The second argument was we need a lender of last resort. We need to be able to bail out banks that go into crisis, the ones that overexpand themselves personally through the fractional reserve system. And they didn't really have a good system for doing that under the National Currency Act. And thirdly, we want to give people some sense of stability here. So they put in a 40% gold reserve requirement for this new currency, this Federal Reserve note currency, which we still have today. Now, you look at that on paper, leaving the elasticity question aside, you say, well, 40% reserve, that's a pretty good amount, one would think. Wrong. Right? Because along comes 1929, 1932, and we discover that 40% was clearly not sufficient. And so what do? Did they learn the lesson under Roosevelt, the banking crisis of 1932? They learned the lesson.
H.R. 192.
Yeah, what they did was exactly the opposite. They said, oh, no, we're not going to pay out any gold. And besides that, we're going to call in all the gold that the American people hold themselves and use that to try and stabilize this system internationally, because they maintained international payments of gold during that period. So instead of correcting the problem, they made it worse. They made the relationship between the bankers and the politicians even tighter than it had been in the past. And we have maintained that, as they used to call it, suspension of specie payments, failure of the banks to pay their debts on their currency, since 1933. It's still with us. Federal Reserve doesn't pay out gold or silver in redemption of its currency, and neither does the Treasury. Now, what's interesting is that although gold was removed from the system in the 1930s, 33 and 34, silver remained in the system.
Oh, the constitutional currency.
Constitutional currency. It's fascinating. These guys didn't even understand enough about the Constitution to know what to do to ruin it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But along comes Kennedy. Kennedy took the first step, which was the depreciation of the silver currency by debasement. And so we went to, eventually, to the what's called the Kennedy half dollars, the Eisenhower dollar coin and so forth, which were 40% silver. And then eventually under Johnson, silver was removed entirely from the
system. Edward, we got our top of the hour break. Folks, stay tuned to this fascinating program.
And silver have been a source of true wealth for years. In fact, people around the world have used these metals to buy and sell goods for over 5,000 years. And gold and silver will continue to be a source of true wealth for the foreseeable future. If you look back in history, you'll see that all fiat currencies have failed to maintain wealth or failed altogether. But gold has always protected its holder, a true asset, usable to anyone around the globe. As the value of your Federal Reserve note continues to depreciate, gold will be your only insurance. As an example, in 1975, you could buy a $40,000 home with 1,000 gold coins. Today, that same house is $400,000, yet you can still buy it with 1,000 gold coins. To find out more information on how to protect your wealth, call Republic Trading at 1-800-691-7898. That's 1-800-691-7898.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
We're back, listeners. My guest is Edwin Vieira. Edwin, right before the break, we were talking about, you were clipping along at a fast pace. You covered the, we missed some important grounds. Can we go back?
Sure. Where do you want
what
to go?
In the last week or so, I've had some debates or arguments with people on the Internet about whether or not the Federal Reserve is a private organization. Explain that for us, please.
Well, I think that's due to two facts. First, they get confused by terminology. They talk about the Federal Reserve. You leave out a word. It's the Federal Reserve System, all right? It's not a Federal Reserve Bank in the sense of the Deutsche Bank, the German Central Bank, which is one unit. It's a Federal Reserve System, and then, of course, you have to look at the parts of the system. Now, the system is made up from the top down of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, seven people who are appointed by the President and confirmed by the Senate. And there's an interesting question as to whether, as under the Bank of the United States, those people are officers of the United States, are government agents. Simply because they're appointed by the President, confirmed by the Senate, doesn't necessarily make it so. But even if you assume that they are officers of the United States, the next level down are 12 corporations, 12 Federal Reserve banks, regional banks. Those were chartered by Congress, but they are private corporations. There are many institutions chartered by Congress that are private corporations. It's been chartering corporations since the Constitution was ratified. These 12 are private corporations, and it's been held as such by the courts. So there's nearly no question that that layer in the system is private.
So an individual bank, like Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, it has its stockholders, member banks.
Well, that's the next, that's the next level.
Okay.
That's the next level. The next level is made up of the stockholders. Now, theoretically, private persons could buy stock in the Federal Reserve System, but if you read the statute, it's very clear that if you are not a member bank and you happen to own stock, you cannot use that stock for voting purposes. Only the member banks that own stock have a vote. The member banks in the system are the national or state banks, commercial banks all over the country. They are clearly private organizations, Chase Manhattan, Bank of America, Wachovia, you name your favorite bank, and you'll find that it's a member of the Federal Reserve System. As a consequence or a requirement, really, of being a member, they have to subscribe 6% of their capital value to stock in their regional bank, because there's 12 different federal regions. Wherever that member bank is, it's part of the structure in that particular region. And then on the basis of that stock ownership, those member banks get to vote for essentially two-thirds of the directors and officers of the regional banks. So there's our control structure. It's a cartel. A large number of these private banks that are given certain kinds of legal monopoly privileges, and it's what would be called in political economic theory a corporative state structure, because it is a cartel in which the government to some degree participates.
But in any event, each Federal Reserve Bank, while it's federally chartered, and of course, hey, look, the Boy Scouts of America was chartered by Congress.
National Education Association.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can run down a list of these people who are.
You know, I've got a list of federally chartered private corporations. Yeah. They've been doing it, as you said, since the Constitution. And that's all the Federal Reserve Banks are, and they're owned by the member banks.
That's right.
And the member banks are private, and therefore, consequently, the Federal Reserve Banks are private. They're nothing more than a federally chartered corporation, a stock-owning, a stock-issuing corporation.
That's right.
It's private, and the courts have been so held, right?
Right, the courts have so held. Lewis versus the United States is a classic example where that the whole thing turned on that question. And it's just a peculiarity that the stock of those regional banks happens to be owned by other banks.
Yeah.
As opposed to individuals in a typical corporation. But that's the structure because it was designed to be a specifically banking cartel.
Okay, Edwin, we got another commercial break. Come back and listen to us for the rest of the program. Another 50 minutes.
In Matthew 24, the disciples asked Jesus, "What shall be the signs of thy coming and the end of the world?" Jesus answered them, "You shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines, diseases, earthquakes in many places. Fellow Americans, we are living in this time of Earth's history. People everywhere are trying to understand these climatic world events in light of human wisdom, but without the wisdom of God, this is impossible. Our ministry would like to offer information on the Mark of the Beast and the Unholy Alliance. It includes four books and several DVDs for your information. It discusses America in prophecy, the Antichrist, tyrants and wars, secret society.
That's 1-210-632-8280. Or visit our site at bedfan.com, your provider for great sleep.
Why continue suffering from pain, illness, and disease when natural health and wellness therapies are within your reach? Hundreds of people are reporting improved health and wellness using Rife frequency technology. In the 1920s, research scientist Royal Raymond Rife discovered that disease organisms can be destroyed using resonant frequencies. The BioSolution frequency instrument uses the same technology for relief or elimination of pain and disease conditions. There are no reported side effects. Join others in discovering a return to natural health and wellness. Just don't treat the symptoms, eliminate the cause. BioSolutions has over 550 pre-programmed auto sequences for various health conditions, and it's very easy to use. Customer satisfaction is guaranteed or your money back. For more information, call BioSolutions toll-free at 866-885-6625. That's 866-885-6625. Once again, that number, 866-885-6625.
My guest today is Edward Vieira. Before the break, Edward, we were talking about the Federal Reserve banks being private. Mm-hmm. So those that are making the argument about this being the government itself, is that's just all wet. What about the board?
Well, that's the interesting question. It has really never been adjudicated one way or the other. And as I say, the historical parallel to the directors of the Bank of the United States was that they were held not to be officers, notwithstanding that the President of the United States and the Senate confirmed, the President appointed, and the Senate confirmed them. So you've got a situation here that's equivocal, ambiguous. But the interesting point is, even if you assume that, the capstone of this pyramid, those seven people, are officers, nonetheless, the way the decisions are made within the system, they are not solely in control. I mean, those corporations are clearly private corporations. The Federal Reserve 12 regional banks are controlled in terms of their directors and officers by the commercial member banks, which are all private banks. And if you look at the major committee that makes decisions on monetary policy, the so-called Federal Open Market Committee, that's made up of the seven Board of Governors, and it's made up of five representatives of the regional banks on a rotating basis. So you say, well, it's a 7-5 majority for this Board of Governors. Well, that's if they all vote the same way. It's certainly conceivable if you have a split on the board that it's the private parties that are going to determine policy. And in any event, you have private parties in there determining governmental policy. I mean, they're participating in the process. And one thing is fairly clear from certainly Supreme Court decisions in the 1930s, when a lot of that type of thing was being done by the Roosevelt administration, the cases that came to the Supreme Court, two famous ones, the Schechter case and the Carter case, in both instances, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously on the particular point. So you can't give that kind, you can't delegate that kind of authority to a private party. Now, the reason the banks are still here is because their system was separate. It was created in 1913. And it was separate from the system that Roosevelt created, the National Industrial Recovery Act and the Bituminous Coal Conservation Act, in the early 1930s. So when those two cases came to the Supreme Court, they dealt with entirely different areas in the economy, and there was never a case that brought up the question of the Federal Reserve structure. Now, recently, let's say in the last 20, 25 years or so, there have been a number of cases going into the U.S. courts in District of Columbia in which various parties have tried to challenge the composition of the Federal Open Market Committee precisely because it has these five undoubted private representatives on it. And every one of those cases, the courts have refused to issue a ruling on the merits. They've avoided it by some standing doctrine or some other avoidance technique, judicial avoidance technique, which tells me that they know bloody well what the situation is. They don't want to face it.
Yeah.
They don't want to admit it. So that's the situation you have. You have private, and it's something that it makes a heck of a lot of sense from the point of view of the history. The history of the relationship of banks and government has always been one of private parties interfacing and interacting through monopoly privilege legislation with the government treasury. The only time we've had something that was different was, of course, the greenbacks under Lincoln. But even the greenbacks under Lincoln, you know what would happen? The Lincoln greenbacks were issued, and the banks would take those greenbacks, and they'd buy government bonds with them. And the government bonds were paying gold interest. And then they'd take the government bonds or the greenbacks themselves, put them into their reserves, and issue their own currency. So there was even an interface there. We've never had a situation in this country under the Constitution where you've had the government, in terms of currency at least, where the government treasury being separate from the banks, except that period during Jackson when you had a complete separation. So it's not surprising, number one, historically. And the reason for it, obviously, is that high finance in this country, private power in the financial market, has a lot of political influence. That's one side of the coin. And the other side of the coin is, by making this relationship, creating this relationship, of course, the politicians benefit because now they can turn to the banks for monetizing debt.
Yes.
And they have the ability to lean, essentially, on the economic power of the high finance circles. So that's the relationship that we have. Now, the difficulty is, it's always been built...
It's true.